Okay. Welcome, everybody. Okay. So this is the last class in our series called Working with Emotions. So I think this is class number 6. So last week we listened to a tape of the Dzogchen Poma Rinpoche, and that's the material we've been using is by that teacher. So it gave people a chance to hear his voice, and he's quite funny, actually, but obviously they edit out all the jokes when they print these books, so you kind of miss the flavor of it. There's information about a CD, if you want to buy it, called Working with Emotions, and that's what this material came from. So it's a little more complete, and it has all the jokes, so it's kind of funny, actually. Poma Rinpoche is talking about a three-step technique for working with emotions in the moment. And we've talked a bit about mindful gap, we listened to the tape, and he described quite a bit about that, but we'll review that a little. And the second one is called clear seeing, the second technique, and the third technique is letting go. So tonight I would like to go into these a little more and have discussions along the way, ask questions, bring up things that, you know, you've been thinking about, and get a real flavor for how we're working with these emotions, because this is not just intellectual study. I think you've already figured that out by now. It's really applied, and it's really about how we work with our mind. And here in Buddhism, we talk about the mind is really what is our best tool in terms of being able to change. And that's why the meditation practice is so important, because that's the point at which we start to look at our own mind and work with our mind. So in conjunction with that, the study is very important because it gives us a bigger view. We can hear from a teacher that may be able to put the teachings in a perspective that we can understand. So I think this material is actually quite unique in terms of the way it's laid out here. So you could say it's kind of a do-it-yourself kit, and nobody really can do it for you. But all we can do is point you in the right direction and say, okay, this is what a teacher we respect, this is how he laid it out, or a way that he's suggesting you can work with it. So the first technique is mindful gap, the first step. And the technique that of mindful gap is divided into three parts. At least three parts. And distancing is the first one. And this is about really creating space between you and the emotion. And just to back up, we're using the English word emotion, but it actually is based on the Sanskrit word called klesha, which is not quite the same. So klesha means a disturbing emotion or an energetic, afflictive emotion. So there's something, a hook. Pema Chodron calls it the hook. So there's something in there that causes a disturbance, a mental disturbance, or some kind of uprising, or, you know, a feeling within us that sort of makes us jump in some way, you could say. Or it can be more subtle than that. So the first sense, the first point here is about distancing. So I wonder if anyone has some comments about that. I've put down the parts of it that he talks about. He talks about first you have to remember. Basically, first you have to remember to create some distance. Mm-hmm. You have to remember the technique. And then you really feel the emotion that's arising. So because you've created this little space, then you can feel the emotion and then hold it, and then with that there's a sense of relaxing. So this is the first instruction. So I'm curious if anyone has been working with this technique, and if you know what this means to you, if you could share, that would be great.
I'm laughing because I was telling Michael about an experience that happened earlier in the week with me where I don't think I was consciously doing any of this, but I think, you know, now as we're talking about it, it's so clear that this was definitely playing out for me. I had something happen like midweek where I had this really, really intense, strong emotional reaction to something that happened, something that somebody said to me that really, like, it was the hook, and I bit it right away. Like, the impulsive, just natural, habitual reaction, like, emotional reaction in that moment. And I felt it, but just the impulsive reaction sort of happened. But I felt like I was able to get distance from it pretty quickly, like, a lot more quickly than, I don't know, in the past. Like, I would have spun with that a lot more, but I felt myself move to that really strong emotional habitual reaction. I recognized it. I took a step back. I sort of redirected myself to my surroundings and kind of where I was at and just paying attention to the environment, getting back in touch with my body. And then moving forward to the next thing that I needed to do after this emotional reaction, but still kind of remembering what that experience was, and I've revisited it now several times, and I've been able to kind of step back into it and remember kind of what it felt like in that moment, and I keep kind of examining, like, what was that reaction about, and what it felt like, and trying to, again, unplug it from the story that was connected to it, and just experiencing the emotion that was there. But I felt like it was clearly, like, that, you know, like, moment of, like, feeling this really strong emotional reaction and then being able to find a way to create a little bit of space from it and to look at it a little bit, to revisit it differently.
So the remembering actually is a little different from how we use that. It's based on what he talked about as recollecting, which is remembering to notice the distance as opposed to thinking about it later. But that's also good to kind of reprocess it and get a more clear perspective on it. So you mentioned lots of things in there that we're actually going to go through tonight. So I think that's really, that's good. So, yeah. Any other comments?
Yeah, sure. I had a pretty potent emotional experience the last 2 weeks. My grandfather just passed away. And he was in the hospital for about a week, and he got the cough and flu, and he just couldn't get over it. And so on the one hand, I was there by his bedside with all my cousins, and like everyone in our whole family was there, and it was very emotional. But so I was very distraught at one point, but then I was able to kind of see that emotion and be able to step back from it and kind of detach from the story and just feel grief, feel the sadness, but then the same day it would just go away. Like, it would be almost like a wave. It's like, it would be really sad at some points, and then all of a sudden I'd be by his bedside, and I wouldn't be sad at all. I would just be there with him. Mm-hmm. There was nothing really wrong. So I had a mindful gap in that sense, and I thought that was pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. And also, it sounds like you were able to be more present.
Completely, yeah.
So, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it was, without getting into all the details, I had the chance to say goodbye to my grandfather and actually say a bunch of words that I wanted to just tell him. And going up to that was really difficult. I was really emotional. I couldn't really hold myself together. But once I started talking and starting going through it, I was like, I kind of settled into the present moment, and it was awesome. There's nothing wrong. It was just me talking to my grandfather, and that was it. So that was really powerful for me.
So this distancing is a very powerful technique, because this is what gives us the space to do something different. It gives us space. And then we actually can make a choice. So the patience, it moves right into cultivating patience. So when there's more distance from the emotion, we have a chance to really investigate the emotion, he says, and get to know it. And we can keep looking at it without reacting. And the effect of this is by practicing patience, we undermine this habitual pattern instead of reinforcing it. So instead of jumping into the emotion, latching onto the storyline, we can actually start to have distance from it, and then it actually undermines the usual way we rush down that pathway. Does that make sense? So it interrupts the usual flow of how we rush head forward around down that path. So patience is really important, and that patience to just hold and be present and keep looking. Then the third point, and this is what we're going to begin talking about tonight, is right view. So you have to be careful with the way they use these words. You could think right versus wrong, but no, it's not that. So it's right as in true, or as it is, it's true. So right view is how we can understand our emotions in a deeper sense, how we can see their true nature. So this is right view. And Panlop Rinpoche talks about labeling the emotion. So there's a sense of labeling the emotion. You could say, oh, that's anger or that's passion. But without fixating on it as being truly existent or permanent. So it's noticing and but not fixating on it. So I'll read this quote, and that might help. Conventionally speaking, the root of our problem with our emotions is our fixation on them as being truly existent and permanent things called anger, jealousy, or passion. That perception is transformed by seeing their impermanent and insubstantial nature. So we generally jump right to the emotion, and we have a story, and that's what holds us there, that whole thing we get tied up in. And then it becomes more and more solid. So this next section, I think, is really important. I put this in bold, which is on my second page, your first page. The emotion is changing because that's its nature. It's impermanent. So what this is really important to think about and, you know, go off from here and really contemplate this. But what he's saying is that the way we see the perception is actually transformed by seeing it's impermanent and insubstantial. So that there is something constantly changing with the emotion. So it's not solid or fixed. And usually we place our concept on something and we glom onto it and we think it's solid. But this is really, we're actually holding a magnifying glass over the emotions at this point. And we're looking at them, Michael, could you give her a copy? More and more carefully we're looking at the emotions. So here he's saying, if you really look, the emotion isn't solid, and it's actually constantly changing. Now, does this make sense? It's impermanent, and it's changing. So why is this really good news? And I think it's because we don't really have, it means that we don't have to solidify the emotion. So whenever there's a chance to have space, there's a chance to do something that's different, and it's more porous. So maybe we could talk about that. I don't know if that sounds confusing or makes sense to people.
The one comment I have is we could also label it as bad news at the same time, couldn't we? If you're saying that all the emotions are impermanent, then things like happiness and joy are also impermanent. So
that's right.
They are.
You could also say but it's good news and bad news because that all the emotions are changing.
But it's not good and bad so much as it just is, right?
Yeah. Right.
You get used to it.
You get used to it. And that is the nature of our reality, see? And that's what's always happening. It's constantly changing. And so Buddhism is really about looking at what is and the way things really are. And we have all our constructs and we're always trying to make things really solid. But in fact, they're never permanent. They're always changing. And where we suffer so much is in trying to solidify things that are going to be changing all the time. So in a way, he's taking this fact of impermanence and applying it here to the emotion and making that making the emotion more permeable. And you can see that it's not so fixed.
The fixation comes from our doing that.
Right.
So in a way, it's a little confusing to say the emotion is not so fixed. I mean, there's always anger. It's anger. Whether or not such and such situation is always going to make me angry is my choice.
But the anger itself, like we use that word, and that's fixing that point in time, but it's actually always changing. So if you really dissect it, it's not going to be the same from minute to minute. It is actually changing.
What we're doing most of the time is an enormous amount of work. Pushing away what we don't want is really heavy, sloggy work we do all the time. And trying to hold on to the happiness is heavy, sloggy right. work making right. us anxious. And those are the things we're trying to lighten up.
I still don't quite see that. If there is a certain situation that has made you angry, and oh, I was so mad, that anger hasn't changed, but my attitude about it has.
Or was it not changed?
Yeah, was it different?
I mean, you're saying that somehow your anger is sort of a permanent entity.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's you who are going through this experience.
Right.
And then when you have the storyline, okay. which is associated with this, which causes this whole process to occur, sets off this whole train of reaction. That's your mind. It's not like it's over there. It's here. It's in us. It's on us. We are creating this experience. We're learning about how to work with that so that it doesn't sort of control us, for one thing, and our mind is not under the control of these places. That's what it refers to. It doesn't mean that you won't get upset when you see something that bothers you, but it doesn't mean that automatically it has to be...
It has to happen.
Right. Yeah, and you have to therefore react in a certain way, and therefore it has to turn into this situation.
Okay. So where's the example of, you know, a death, say? Mm-hmm.
The what?
Obviously
a death.
A death.
Yeah.
You know, somebody close to you. Obviously, you know, assuming you like that person and are close to that person, there's going to be sadness and a lot of, you know, very justified, normal emotion. So I guess where I'm getting lost is it almost sounds like we're talking about, you know, feeling these things as being a bad thing.
But those, grief isn't really a klesha. So this is where we get in trouble. We use the word emotion. So when you're with your grandfather who's dying and your heart is breaking and you want to say something and there's this moment, that we use the word emotion in English, but it's not what we're talking about here. It's not a klesha. That's a normal human reaction to what's happening in your life. And
so you're not saying that he should separate the story of his grandfather dying from what he's feeling.
In that case, no, I wouldn't say, but he still can give more space around the whole thing without...
Yeah, and I would say, like, that it's really complex going through that, obviously, and there's an aspect to it where I am attached to my grandfather, and I don't want to let him go, and that's a klesha. That's good. Where it's like, I've experienced so much with him, but I don't want to let him go. And that's a suffering that I'm putting on myself.
That.
So if I can distance myself from that, then that suffering doesn't exist.
So how do you do that?
Good point.
Be present. In the present moment, someone is dying in front of you, and that's just a fact of life. But trying not to ruminate on all the times that I had with him, or I don't know, it's difficult, but it's possible. I was there with him, and I can tell all of you here, it's possible.
And you described
I've been through it three times, and had somebody die in my arms, and the last time was 3 years ago, and I still haven't gotten over it. Mm-hmm. And so
I think it also plays into the part of permanence and impermanence. So we all struggle with the idea that our lives are impermanent, or our human life is impermanent. Our human body life is impermanent, and but we don't want to accept that. So it's the same thing with emotions. Emotions change all the time. We change all the time. It's just coming to grips with that, I think, which is no easy task.
Yeah. I mean, that's the part that I read this and I go, oh, I get it intellectually,
right?
You know, but then putting it into play is a whole different ballgame.
What do you mean getting over it? Because you said the last person was 3 years ago. What do you mean getting over it? What does that mean to you?
Having it not affect me in ways that are unhealthy, I guess. You know, or sort of. I mean, I'm in a better place now than I was a year ago, but. Not being able to have that attitude that, you know, life is impermanent, and you know, just not being able to accept that person isn't here anymore.
I think if you had three people die in your lives, it's huge. I mean, maybe, you know, the cumulative effect too is like maybe
there's
it's too
I
much
handled
to
the third one I didn't.
Maybe it's too much to expect sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you can let go and say not supposed to affect me permanently. I mean, maybe that's not. I don't know.
I don't think the question of saying I'm not going to be affected by this.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with it at all. I mean, we are being affected by everything, and that's fine. It's not like we're supposed to turn into kind of like some kind of impervious entity that just sort of like a something bounces off of you and nothing penetrates. If your heart's really affected, then. But I think the point that Padma Rinpoche is bringing up, and we talk about, we talked earlier about the notion of issues of difficulties that actually could be viewed in a more friendly manner, so we don't view them as threatening and as something that is going to fundamentally be the recipe for our unhappiness. But we are willing to be there with it. We are open ourselves up to this. So the complex issues that are around that person's death that you experienced this last time that you threw you into this kind of like tailspin, you know, that's part of what is the process of healing, to learn and to experience. And when we're going through these practices right here that we're discussing, the distancing, simply seeing it, feeling it, opening up to it, and relaxing, and then investigating it, and then learning about the right view, which is actually a process we all go through all the time, of particularly coping with impermanence, I think. I mean, this is a very major... We've been studying this the Dharma for some time now, and we at least introduced in our course here, we introduced the whole notion of impermanence as being one of the basic problems of suffering.
And causing suffering.
Elements of suffering. It's just fundamental. It's all pervasive, inescapable. And coming to terms with that is, you know... For many, it's a lifelong proposition.
So. I wanted to, Diane.
Well, when I think about a recurring emotion or klesha, I think when something happens again and again, you tend to think it is something real, like it defines a relationship or it defines a way you are in life. And I guess that's a sign that you really are distancing and looking at it as an emotion.
So that you aren't?
You aren't. You're like thinking it is something real.
Right.
I think of my relationship with my daughter-in-law that I kind of suffer about ongoingly. She lives in California, so I don't see her much, but I was just there. And I have this expectation that I'm going to feel, you know, rejected or sort of not sure that she likes me or all these things. Just kind of, they're there like they're a thing. And I'm really not. I've been working on this for 10 years. And I still haven't got beyond it. So anyway, I'm just thinking, I'm making it a...
Well, you feel solid, and you have your expectations when you show up. And that's why it is. It's a challenge to go beyond. And I think we're going to get more into some of other aspects of this. So I think, like, starting to work with it as a progression, too, can really help. And the more you work on the distancing and then patience and, you know. So let's look now at the... So changing our outlook is another aspect of this, which he puts under step one, mindful gap. So this material here is actually preliminary to what we're going to be starting on next week on Lojong. So he says changing our outlook, you could see how someone, for example, who is irritating us could actually be helping us. So... he says that if we focus on their negative qualities, we're actually increasing our own suffering. But we could instead just reverse the whole situation. And we could see that this difficult situation, working with it, could actually strengthen our mindfulness. So this is what we're going to be working on in Lojong practice, mind training, which is really reversing the way you see something. So normally... Let's say you have a really irritating boss or something. It's very difficult, and every time that person comes in the room, you start to clutch or something. Then he's saying here that situation, instead of rejecting it and trying to push it away or run away from it, actually you reverse the way you see it and you welcome the opportunity to actually work with your mind in that relationship. And therefore, you could actually see it differently. So you could see this difficult situation as a possibility of bringing you actually liberation, because you could see this person in a different light. You could have a different view. You could see more things about yourself and other ways of working with it. So... that's what we're going to be working on coming up. So we'll have more techniques that will come along. In fact, 59 slogans. So let's move on here to step two. So step two is clear seeing. So some other ways of putting that, clear seeing, is insight or vipassana. So vipassana is a Sanskrit word. That's why I wrote it out here. So that'll help you in the future. And the idea of clear seeing, he talks about zooming out. So now there's a sense of having more distance and seeing the emotion clearly, seeing the complete picture, and getting more of a sense of the environment around the emotion as well. So he's talking both about the... more precisely identifying the emotion, knowing it, defining the qualities and characteristics so we get more familiar with it, and then also recognizing the landscape around it. So he says in terms of the identifying our emotions, so in order to effectively and progressively transcend or let go of our disturbing emotions, we need to know and see them clearly. We need to know exactly what they are, how they arise, where they are in our body, where they go when we chase after them, and so on. This process of clearly defining our emotions is an essential precursor to any ability to truly free ourselves from their painful hold on us. And then he goes into evaluating the emotion, which he's mentioned in this paragraph. So how do we experience the emotion? So this is really now, again, though he talks about zooming out, here we're almost zooming in again. Is the emotion very strong or is it really weak? So he talks about more coarse emotions or a more suppressed emotion that's kind of an undercurrent of feeling. And then he talks about triggering, recognizing the landscape of our emotions. So look at what triggers our emotions. What environmental factors influence or support the emotion? He says, when we can predict the ways in which our emotions are likely to arise and be triggered, we will gain some power in the situation. So I'm thinking about Diane's comment and going and dealing with her daughter-in-law. I'm thinking about situations we probably all had as we grew to adulthood, and then we went back home, and we went back into our family situation, and maybe with siblings, and everybody plays their old roles again. You know, they fall into your old patterns, and that's one way. I think that was one example that came to me at seeing the emotional landscape around family situations. That always is quite vivid for me. So clear seeing allows us to zoom out, and we can see the subject, which is usually us, and the object, which is usually something out there, more clearly. So we have there's more clarity in how we can see things, because first we've had more space, and then we're actually looking. We're looking at the emotion rather than just being jerked around by it and reacting so fast that we don't really see beyond that immediate reaction. So what do people think about the second step, the clear seeing, and does that make sense to you, or how do you see that you might be able to apply that? Mary?
The clear seeing I try to do quite often lately, because it allows me to identify what I'm feeling, mm-hmm. but not get stuck in a web of it. So it's honoring, okay, I'm not going to smash it down and ignore it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to actually name it, identify it, and then let's not rush to the reaction. Let's take a little breath and let me think, how would I handle this, or why am I feeling this way, and do a little quick check before I'm leaping into something that would get me into more drama, or even just in my own head.
Yeah.
You know, not extend the story forever and ever, and then I'm all worked up.
Yeah.
So I find that then I can actually react to something a little cleaner, made hopefully a little wiser.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good. So I calm down. I calm down from that.
Yeah.
I don't get as revved up.
Mm. Right. So that that allows you to relax, and you have more space around it. And then whatever you do may be more appropriate then at that point.
Or at least I'm a little more awake about what I'm doing, even if, I don't know, you know, it doesn't work the way I think it should.
Right.
I'm just awake about the steps I'm taking. It feels a little bit more at ease for me.
Uh-huh. Nick, did you have something?
I was just going to say, I could really relate to what you said right before, where, you know, with the family situations being opportunities to work and kind of sculpt your, you know, enlightenment, because those opportunities, or even the death that you were talking about, it's so real And that's just such a great opportunity to practice some of the things that we're learning, and almost to the point where you welcome them because they're like, oh shoot, this is real, you know, this is real, and then you can pump the brakes and it starts over. But I'm sorry, is it Pat or
Ann?
Ann, I'm sorry. But that death, it's just, you have to graduate to that. I feel like going back to that, I mean, we graduate with like jealousy, you know, you have to kind of condition that. You can't expect to have that, if, you know, your whole life. This is the human condition. We're all going through it, rich, poor, you know, good health or not. So I think you really have to be open, accepting of where you are. In terms of your understanding, or even your situation with your daughter-in-law, and I mean that's a special circumstance where you can really, you know, understand it. And we all have our special circumstances. Just tuning into them.
I'm not going to wait until I'm 80. I'm good at working out the stuff in my own head and feeling like I have to process it.
Yes.
That's why I don't let go of it. Nobody wants to hear it.
Wait, say that again? I missed that point.
Just, you know, we'll try to do more of this distancing and looking at why is it coming up now? Why am I feeling it now? In my head, but it's hard to process this and realize what's going on when you're just thinking.
As opposed to saying it out loud to you?
As opposed to talking it over with someone.
Oh, I see. Working it out more in your own mind.
Yeah, because once I get flooded with the emotion,
right,
feeling,
right, then you're already in the track of
your
habitual patterns.
Yeah.
You're hooked. Yeah,
that's
it
what
is.
I was saying is that how do you separate yourself from it? Separate yourself from the story once you're already flooded with the emotion.
Right.
I would say that it, you just need to be patient with yourself. I know from in my experiences, I will be deep in a story in my head, and all of a sudden be like, oh, I'm in a story. And then I can slowly come out, whether that be by breathing or listening to what's going on around me or anything like that. But then it might be for a second, and then boom, right back into the story. But even for that 1 second, you know, you come out, it's like you realize, okay, I can come out of it, and it's okay. So I think being real, like what you're saying, is being real with yourself on where you are in the moment right now, and understanding that you don't expect to be this all-enlightened person right here, right now. I mean, that's possible to go into each moment, and you have moments of where everything's at peace, but to expect that you're going to be like that every moment is, I think, a tough expectation. Would you guys agree, or...?
Yeah,
sure. I would say it's pretty impossible.
We have a big
Michael.
Yeah, we have a big reservoir of things we haven't felt, and I know I do, and it sounds like you do. And the process then is not to expect that we're going to just go beyond it, but to actually feel each one, to let them come up, to feel the quality of it in our body and our mind, to feel the texture, to know maybe even what brings it up, but that which is an analytical part, but mainly to start feeling all the things that we're not feeling. And it seems like you piled it up, and then you piled it up, and then a third time, it was kind of too much.
I think they were different. I hear what you're saying. I do think that, I was raised in a family where talking about the weather was a deep conversation.
Well,
so, you know,
yeah.
Feelings didn't exist.
Right.
At the age of 52, I'm starting to, like, understand what, you know,
yeah,
really like having to look at a piece of paper with words or lists of different feelings to even know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to have somebody say to me, "How do you feel about that?" and I start explaining something, and they're like, "No, you're
you're
dissecting
going,
it. You're intellectualizing it. You're not telling me how you feel. Well, I need a piece of paper to give me words to cue me because I don't know what those words are.
Yeah.
And be patient about that.
I think some situations, though, save the dissecting for later. I'm thinking about what your situation may be with your daughter-in-law's. It might be on the plane on the way home or afterward where you can, now what is that emotion all about? Where it's a little, you're already distanced physically from the situation. I find for me that's been very helpful. Even retrospect of a painful event from 10 years ago or 8 years ago. And not long ago, I thought, what is that all about? Right? And it could still hurt me. But I have thought about it. I know what it was about. I understand that.
But what do you do at the moment?
Sometimes you can't do it. Sometimes you just can't. Mm-hmm. So if you can't,
then you can't.
Then you can't.
But you can, work on it.
But you can work on it. You can think about it at another time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're physically away from that person who's pushing your button right then and there or something, there is a chance to step back and recall and begin to think about it. I mean, it begins with baby steps.
Yeah. And I one thing that I discovered is, like, with different situations in my family, with the way people are reacting to me or whatever, I always think, whatever, it's because of something I'm doing. And then it finally occurred to me, oh, they're having a bad day, or it has nothing to do with me. It's just how they're reacting to me because I happen to be there. That was a revelation, because everything, this storyline, it's all about me. It really, that's the way it always feels. Like, you know, they look at you and it's wrong or something. And so I think, again, that's part of this process of noticing and dissecting the emotion and being more astute.
I had a weekend with a Qigong teacher, and or Tai Chi, and he said, just out of the blue, he said, by the way, if somebody irritates you, it's not about you. Don't think it's about you. It's about them. So don't worry about it. It's really about them. And I just think about that all the time. And sometimes when I do get caught in a situation, or when I'm talking to a good friend or my husband, and he'll be irritated with, it's not about you, it's about them. You know? I think that's just so true.
Well, I had a recent experience of where I was having to do a business deal, and because I'm very open and share what I know to the people who I work with on every side, you know, I see how they want to take advantage of this. And then I'm this messenger guy who's in the middle, who's going back and forth, just trying to relate. But if I relate what they really want, it's not going to happen because they're so pushy. Then the other person's saying, well, forget it, I'm not dealing with this. So I told them, look, I'm on the firing squad, I'm getting hit on both sides, you know. whatever you do, it would seem as though it's your fault. But, you know, I realize each of these guys have a different agenda. And so if I can understand what that is, I let it rest for what it is, and then somehow the whole situation goes, well, that's where you are, and that's where he is, and I'm going to find a way to make this work here by not taking it on myself as though they're mad at me, because the way it sounds when they talk is they're directing it to me, they're not directing it to somebody else, you know. And so it's interesting how this plays out in the business dynamic, too. And I was relieved to just watch this and go, oh yeah, you know, this is their, everybody's got their storyline, right? I have my storyline, but my storyline is just to basically make this digestible to two people. Otherwise, this whole thing won't happen. So it was interesting to see how that could work, and you can see how things blow apart when everybody starts taking this personally, as though it's my fault that this is happening, that this person's upset. And you know, there are times when they are mad. And it is, and then if that's the case, you know, that's okay. It's clear. I mean, I get chewed out all the time by opening my mouth in different ways around you guys.
Poor
in
Michael.
In front of you people, you know. Like, oh, well, what did he say tonight? Oh, God. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, I just work with that. I mean, I understand. It's like, you know, recognizing a willingness to accept
you know, I can do something that's incorrect, okay, or inappropriate, then let me take it on, let me eat it, and at the same time, let me learn from it. But I don't have to put myself on the cross about it. I mean, this is like, no. You know, if not like that, it's like there's a quality of letting the thing pass through you, you know, on some level of being open to that clarity. And as Michael was saying, I mean, I know it sounds sometimes so far-fetched when we're in the middle of having an emotional state of possession, but just popping into the moment right now, just being right here, mm-hmm. just wait a minute, I'm here right now. I'm not 5 minutes ago, 20 years ago with that person. I'm here right now in this moment. And, you know, just being here in itself is a tremendous source of power. There was a guy, you may have heard of him, called Eckhart Tolle. He wrote The Power of Now. Very interesting book in terms of just, he was ready to blow his brains out because he'd been so wrapped up about people telling him what he had so much expectation about how he was supposed to deal with being somebody. And, you know, finally, he says suddenly, wait a minute, you know, I'm here, what is all this? And it's like there's this kind of unraveling that can happen on the spot, you know, when we're really willing to just be here. That's why meditation is so important. Because we're just coming back. We're watching our thoughts go through this stuff. We're watching all the dramas and all the dreams and all the craziness. And then we're just, oh, you know.
That's the letting go. Step three.
I'm sorry, Pop. I
jumped ahead. That's okay. Roberta.
I was thinking, Michael, it's empathy doing couples therapy with these two people. you know, but I was going to say that, I mean, for me, I have a therapist, talking to her helps me distance myself. So instead of, like you were saying, going around and around in my own head, like sometimes I need to talk to another person and see, I hear how it sounds out loud, mm-hmm. and then how it's received and reflected back to me. So that really does help me understand what's going on in a very similar way. The way the Buddhism does. So, I mean, for me, I needed another person to talk to and to help me look at things. And it's not totally unlike mm-hmm. what you said.
Well, that can be helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's look at point three, step three, which is letting go. So I find this a little opaque, I have to admit. So step three is we let go of the emotion. So Pumla Rinpoche presents some interesting material around how to let go. And he says that we release some of the energy each time that we work with the emotion. And I think that has to do with over and over again. It's not, it's that by working with the emotion and going through these steps, it deflates it in some way. It doesn't, it's not so immense. There's a sense of lightening it up. He says the part that's left behind, that's like if you release the energy behind the emotion little by little, the part that's left behind is called a habitual tendency or a subtle obscuration. So he compares this to the trace that remains like the scent in a perfume bottle. When it's empty, you never really get all the smell out. So there's a sense of this, you know, this kind of remainder there. So again, the two stages, he says, are release the energy little by little, over and over again. And the second is that we're going to be working then at a more subtle level. And we have to actually exert ourselves even more to work with that more subtle level, which he calls the bottom thing here. Ultimately, you have to let go of the let goer or the person yeah. who's letting go. So that's the ultimate view here of, again, back to non-self or letting go of this ego fixation. Yes.
Step three, I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
About when it says clear seeing allows us to zoom out and see the subject and object more clearly. Mm-hmm. That to me sounds sort of like there's a self and there's an action. And, you know, I that we were sort of getting away from.
Well, there's the relative truth, and then there's a more absolute view. So here we're talking more of kind of our daily life relative truth
view. The relative truth.
Yes.
The subject and object.
Subject and object, right.
Okay.
Right. So you feel like the subject, the most important person, right? And then there's an object, something out there that's irritating you or making you happy. Or
you're working in the relative.
And so he's saying, instead of those being very close together, when you zoom out, there's more space around it. And you can see more of the environment around it.
The object is not the emotion, it's what's
the trigger.
Upsetting us, the trigger.
And usually we project out, right, to something outside of us as they're making me mad. Well, really? That's what we're questioning now, all these ways of seeing. So letting go, he actually brings in working on the level of body and mind. And relaxing the body, with body, relaxing the body. He talks about kind of taking a good posture, which is a way of kind of meeting your mind in a certain way, and using your breath. People always talk also, you know, about relaxation in terms of just take a deep breath when things get tough, you know, take a deep breath. And with mind, he talks about awareness, and that's what we've been talking about as we've been going along here. Label the emotion and let go. And this is, in a way, very similar to what we learn in our shamatha meditation technique. So in meditation, thoughts come up, and we notice them, and we let go. They may be a deluge of thoughts, and we may notice a lot of thoughts, and eventually we see a space back to this present moment. We might have a thought with a lot of energy, and that can be an emotion. So in Buddhism, we even talk about emotions as thoughts, that it's really nothing different than a thought with a lot of color in it. So you can think of it as a thought where there's more happening or more energy.
Juice.
That's a good word. Juice. It's juice. So when we meditate, we label them as thinking and come back to the breath. So in the same way, we're really looking at the emotion and then letting go into this more open space. So the little chart on the bottom is a summary. Mindful gap is really related to shamatha practice. And shamatha is what we do when we sit on the cushion and we notice our thoughts and come back to the breath. That's also called calm abiding. And calm abiding meditation or mindfulness. So we hear those words a lot. We hear mindfulness more these days. And clear seeing is associated with vipassana. And that's also called insight meditation or awareness. So it's helpful, I think, sometimes to see the words laid out this way. So can you see the relationship here between the first step, mindful gap, and shamatha, and the second step as clear seeing or this insight or awareness? Can you see a relationship between the emotions and how we work with meditation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the last step, he calls letting go as vipassana. Also, I don't know. Does that make sense to people? Does that make sense to you?
It hasn't been. We haven't studied enough.
We haven't really.
At this point,
that's
to understand
true.
The implications of what vipassana is.
Right.
Vipassana also relates to something much greater, much vaster,
right?
Much more profound, which is fundamental awareness.
Right.
And in awareness, itself. Which is just completely pure in itself, all the stuff drops away very freely, effortlessly. But the inner effort has to be in clear seeing. We have to stay with it and not just get relaxed and think that's enough because, you know, I'm calmed down now, I can forget about it. I'm willing to be open to what this is. It's obviously a message. I'm open to the message. may I actually work with that message? Yeah. One more quick thing. We're not really trying to get rid of anything.
No, that's important.
That's really an important point. We actually discussed this at the very beginning, but, you know, oftentimes we just pass through it and go on. Yeah, right. We're only trying to do what we're doing, but we're really trying to be here. We're really trying to arrive where we never really left and never knew we were here already, as it were. There's nowhere to go, you know, except where we are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I don't like it. Oh, okay. I always want to go somewhere else.
Well, I'll take the train on.
I think we are talking about relieving suffering.
Yes.
So much of our suffering does come from our constructs of whatever pain or think we have suffered from. You know, and this is a way to help relieve your own suffering.
Right.
Doesn't mean that suffering will keep happening to you, but at least you're not going to be enclosed in that.
Your relationship to it changes.
That's the good way to put it, yeah. That's right.
Right. This is a journey, and what it means to us will always be different as we work with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's always changing.
We never get the answer to the question. Instead, we unless we get totally awake, but our relation to the question and what we don't understand keeps getting more relaxed and joyful. So we're on a journey.
Yeah. What's coming up for me right now is I could do this, but I don't want to do it. I want the other person to have awareness about them. Mm-hmm. So this is like a punishment almost. Like, I'm not going to just be the one to adapt.
Well, we're going to study.
Wait till we get into the next stuff.
These absorbents is just about
just
how
like
to transform that,
that
situation. Mm-hmm. We are working with other people. We're not only working about little old us. We're actually working with everything. We're learning how to work with the world. And so these slogans will help us take that step forward. Mm-hmm. In terms, but don't try to change the other person before you know your own mind. You know, if you're just trying to fix things up because it's bothering you, then you're not even checking in about where this experience is going.
I'm in a weak position. I realize that.
Which means we're in a strong position.
Right.
Because our goal is not to rework the world. We're going to have 10 ways of digging in and twisting with that until it becomes joyful.
It's going to be quite juicy, I think.
Yeah.
So it's
turn up the juice.
Yeah, it's more applied. It's the next section is really, it really hits home more and more. And so you always see, I mean, what you just described is pretty much how we react to a lot of things. And so we're going to work with reversing our usual pattern of reaction.
It was a great saying that I had read by Buddha. He said, be grateful to those who have helped, to those who have hurt you, and to those who have been indifferent, because they all give you the context in which you can be enlightened, you know, be a Buddha, come to your Buddha nature. And you do. If those situations are great.
Yeah.
Embrace them, and
she's a gift to me.
This
reminds me so much of the way my friend talks about her Al-Anon meetings, about not being able to change the other person. Mm-hmm. Your only hope is changing yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, and not going crazy with the other person.
Well, knowing what you can,
alcoholism,
and knowing the difference between what you can
do, things I can, and the only thing you have a prayer of changing.
If you change your vibration, that could affect others.
That could affect the others, mm-hmm. but you've got to start relieving yourself from trying to get the alcoholic to stop drinking or trying to change the other person's behavior.
Right.
Because if you're locked into that,
it's a struggle then.
Yeah.
I always find it interesting when I finally really, truly let go, not just say, I'm let going of this. I really feel it. Something shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Just in that energy of finally just.
Mm-hmm. I think the key to that, though, is not having any expectation that something else is going to shift.
Right.
Just letting go for the sake of letting go and not doing it, hoping that, all right, if I let go now, this is what I hope is going to happen.
Right. Because then you're still holding the rope.
Yeah.
Right?
Very good. Good comments. Well, thank you. Any final comments or anything?
Yeah, I'd say I've dealt with that a lot in going on or embarking on this journey to try to understand my mind, and then seeing people in my life that aren't on it, aren't aware of like the journey or aren't looking at them, and that used to frustrate me a lot. But then I kind of did an exercise where I'd be like, okay, how would I feel? How would my life be different if these people were following the path that I was? And I think about myself in that situation, and I say, "Well, why I can be that way right now? I don't. Everything outside in the world, like I can point my finger at it and say that this is holding me back from doing this. This is holding me back from doing that. Or you can point the finger back at yourself and say, no, I'm just creating a barrier for myself right now. And if I let that barrier go, then everything kind of just dissipates, and you can be fine with it." So I guess maybe our expectations are a huge barrier for our growth. If we expect a situation to be a certain way, then most often it's not going to turn out the way that you expect, and then that just creates suffering.
Okay, so we'll close. Okay, we're going
to
turn that off first, Jeff.
And at the end.
Yeah.